It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Central Time, new research shows that rural moms and their babies are some of the hardest hit victims of the opioid epidemic.
First, this morning, Governor Scott Walker called for a special legislative session to address the heroin and opioid abuse epidemic in Wisconsin.
In a press release, the governor said he was wrapping up the state's response to what he called a public health crisis. Part of that response will be to implement recommendations from the opioid task force he convened in September.
Jessie Opoyan is with us now. She's the state government and politics reporter for the Capital Times. Jessie, welcome back.
Hey, thank you for having me.
What reason did Governor Walker give for calling this special session?
He wants to show the urgency on this and to show what a priority this is. He'd convened this task force in September and was waiting for the report to come out. And now that these recommendations are in, you know, this is the time of year as we wait for the session to begin that everyone's looking to see what is the priority going to be? You know, what are the most important issues that legislators are going to tackle? And this is sort of a signal from the governor that this is where that energy needs to be focused. And he said earlier today, speaking publicly, that a lot of work has already been done on this, and that's been we've seen some results from it, but there's still a lot more work to be done. We're still seeing what he referred to as crisis numbers, and that's why the special session now.
So why call a special session? Why not address some of these legislative priorities within the regular session?
This allows it to expedite a little bit. It ensures that the focus will be on this, that they won't get lost in the shuffle with other more day-to-day legislation. And it also makes sure that these things are addressed before we start discussions about the budget, which the governor is supposed to give his budget proposal in about a month.
So what are some of the changes that we can expect to see coming out of this special session?
Sure. I'm going to pull up a list for you here so I can talk about these, but it's really sort of an all-encompassing approach. There are recommendations related to legislative proposals, recommendations related to things the governor can do, things that his administration and agencies can do. Along those lines, some public awareness efforts and some funding efforts. But there's a pretty long list of legislative proposals that they'd like to see come out of this report. And again, that comes from the task force that was headed up by Representative John Nygren and Lieutenant Governor Rebecca Clayfish. So a couple of those proposals would be allowing school nurses and other school employees to administer Narcan to help reverse the effects of an opioid overdose if a student were to overdose while they were at school. One proposal would be to allow the University of Wisconsin to authorize a charter school for high school students that are struggling with addiction. It would allow them to receive inpatient treatment while they continue their high school education. They wouldn't have to take time off for a semester. In previous bills that were passed, the legislature allowed a Good Samaritan law that it gives limited immunity. If you call 911 or you bring someone to the emergency room that has an overdose, that allows limited immunity for the people who brought the person in or who made the call. This report is also recommending that immunity also be granted to the person who overdosed to really try to encourage people to call 911 in the event that something like that happens. There are some components that would involve physician training, giving doctors more resources to connect with experts, to research treatments, a lot of that would focus on rural areas too. Looking at some recovery efforts, investing in treatment and diversion alternatives, and a lot of grants, a lot of funding that they're looking at. They are also looking at giving the Department of Justice a little over $400,000 to hire a few more criminal investigation agents that would focus on going after drug traffickers in Wisconsin.
Jessie Opoyan is with us now. She's the state government and politics reporter for the Capital Times, talking about a special session called by Governor Scott Walker just this morning to address the opioid epidemic here in Wisconsin. And Jessie, did the governor this morning talk at all about the scope of the problem in Wisconsin as it stands that is necessitating this urgent action?
This is something, again, that we've known as a problem for several years that Representative Nygren started addressing within the legislature back in 2013-2014. But the statistics that the governor reminded us of today are that more people last year died from accidental drug overdoses than from vehicle accidents. And of all those drug overdose deaths, heroin and opioids accounted for 3/4 of them.
Now, you mentioned how Representative Nygren has been a driving force behind the report that the governor is acting on, along with Representative Clayfish. And I wonder if you could give us some background about Representative Nygren's story and how he might be feeling today, given that this special session has been a special interest of his for a long time.
Yeah, he's really the legislator who sparked this effort in the legislature. And it was a personal fight for him. His daughter, Cassie, has struggled with addiction and, you know, been in recovery, relapsed, is back in recovery, has really lived that story that is common to so many people in Wisconsin. But she was willing to work with him and put a face on this problem and help him step forward and bring some action to the legislature. So, I mean, the things that he's proposed, that the efforts that he's led have been approved just unanimously. He's gotten more and more people on board. It's Democrats, Republicans, some going off on their own, coming up with additional ideas. There was another coalition led over the summer that was trying to come up with some ideas and sort of culminated with the governor creating this task force, which he appointed Representative Nygren to be one of the leaders on that to do this. He's been recognized not just in the state but nationally as someone who's leading the way on this.
Now, Wisconsin right now, when it comes to politics, it's a state divided. Is this one of those rare issues where we are seeing bipartisanship both in the past on this epidemic of opioid abuse and also the future?
It really is. And, you know, like any other issue, there are partisan fights to be had about it, about, you know, what should have been done in the past to prevent some of these problems. But in the spirit of moving forward and actually addressing them and doing something, everything that that's been proposed has gotten overwhelming bipartisan support. You know, the HOPE agenda is what this package of legislation is called, and the first set of bills focused almost entirely on heroin. The second set focused a lot more on prescription painkillers, sort of recognizing those as the gateway, the entrance to the problem. And, you know, we've seen legislators agreeing to add more money for treatment and diversion programs, things that often can be fought about when in terms of putting a budget together or just crafting legislation. People are generally just 100% on board.
And as you were saying, this special session is a move to urge state agencies to ramp up their efforts to combat opioid abuse in Wisconsin. Do we have a sense about what that might look like from these agencies? Are they equipped to take action and to take action quickly?
Yeah, you know, what we'll see from that is certainly some of them are already equipped to take action. The recommendations for this report include some reorganization. One recommendation would be to allocate a position, sort of a secretary director level position within the Department of Health Services to coordinate some of these efforts, bring some more organization to what's being done, grant funding to add more positions where they're needed. But, you know, they're on sort of a decently solid base footing, but if these proposals are enacted as they're designed, then that will help get things going a little faster.
Did you hear any reaction from advocates today to this action?
Yeah, a lot of overwhelming support, I would say. And again, from both politicians on the left and the right, but yes, so, I mean, those in the addiction and recovery community are cheerleading this. The Hospitals Association is on board and applauded this. Kind of every player at the table, every stakeholder is got a positive reaction to this.
So what do you think is the very first action we might be seeing on this in the next couple of weeks?
Well, what'll happen is, well, these bills are still in draft form right now, so they'll have to go into that next step and become actual bills that are proposed and introduced and debated and discussed. The Assembly and Senate are finalizing based on when those bills are introduced, when they'll actually get on the floor to take them up. But I think, you know, we'll certainly hear more from the governor in his State of the State address, and I'm sure additionally in his budget address, more details on how he would like to see them implemented. But the next step for the most part is to wait and see when these bills are actually introduced and when the Assembly and Senate can vote on them.
So, Jesse, again, the special session being called on, what is it, the third day that the legislature is in session. Is it unusual to have a special session called this early in the game?
It is unusual. We were trying to figure out when the last time that would have been, and I wasn't able to get an answer on that. But it's definitely not something we see every year or every few years. Certainly these are things that the legislature could have acted on without a special session, but in terms of optics and in terms of just signifying the importance, having a special session does that, accomplishes that.
Jesse, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate your time today.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
That was Jesse O'Poyan. She's state government and politics reporter for the Capital Times, and talking there about a special session which was called this morning by Governor Scott Walker to take an urgent look to require state coordination of agencies to address the opioid and heroin epidemic here in Wisconsin.
Coming up in just a few moments, we'll take a closer look at one particular problem with this opioid epidemic in Wisconsin. We'll look at the impact it's having on rural mothers and their babies. Today's coverage, just part of our ongoing coverage of the opioid and heroin epidemic here in Wisconsin. You can find more over at WPR.org, past interviews with policymakers, with healthcare experts, with people working on solutions, people who have dealt with addiction themselves or in their own families. Again, you can find all of that over at WPR.org. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferris.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, it's the time of year when people try to build better health habits. We'll talk to a guest with suggestions about how to make those habits stick. Coming up.
Right now, as we just heard, Governor Scott Walker called for a special legislative session today to address the state's opioid epidemic, which he said is a public health crisis. While there's no part of the state or segment of the population that's immune from the impacts of opioid addiction, there have been some groups who have been affected more than others.
New data shows that rural mothers and their babies have been hit especially hard. Dr. Nicole Villapiano joins us now. She's a pediatrician at the University of Michigan and works with its Institute for Healthcare Policy and Innovation. Dr. Villapiano, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you looked at what's called neonatal abstinence syndrome along with maternal opioid use. What were you looking for?
Right. So we know from the research in the past few years that the opioid epidemic is accelerating at a rapid pace all across the United States. And we've seen this prominently in rural areas when it comes to things like overdose deaths related to opioids and other opioid-related complications. But what we didn't know was how the opioid crisis in America was affecting rural moms and their infants. So for me, as a pediatrician, I was really concerned, and I wanted to take a look at how rates of neonatal abstinence syndrome differed in rural versus urban areas over the past 10 years.
And what did you find?
So back in 2004, for every 1,000 babies that were born, one baby would be born from neonatal abstinence syndrome. And this was the same across the board, whether the mom was from a rural area or an urban area. Over the following 10 years, rates of neonatal abstinence syndrome increased both in rural and urban areas, but in rural areas, there was a nearly sevenfold increase, whereas in urban areas, there was only a fourfold increase.
That is a large increase. So what does that tell you about what's happening in those communities, those rural communities, where you're seeing this big increase?
Right. So our study couldn't address the underlying causes, but what we do know from other research is that rural communities tend to be lower income. They tend to have more people that are dealing with substance use and mental health issues, and there's less access to care, both primary care doctors and specialists like mental health doctors or doctors who take care of patients who are using substances. So because of all of those factors. It creates a perfect storm for the opioid crisis to hit rural areas in an especially hard way. And what our study is showing is that it's really affecting rural moms and their babies.
Let's talk a little bit more about what neonatal abstinence syndrome is. How would you define it?
Sure. So neonatal abstinence syndrome is what happens to babies who are exposed to opioids in their mother's womb. When the babies are born and they no longer have opioid exposure from the mom, they go through a period of opioid withdrawal. And when I take care of these babies in the hospital, I see that their symptoms can range from anything from difficulty taking a bottle to jitteriness, difficulty sleeping, irritability, and in some cases more serious problems like difficulty breathing, prematurity, poor growth, and seizures. So overall, these babies just look really uncomfortable, and they are really uncomfortable. Their symptoms can last anywhere from several days to many weeks, and some babies with neonatal abstinence syndrome require special treatment to help control their symptoms.
Do we know whether there are any long-term health implications when a baby is born with this?
You know, that's a great question, and right now there's a lot of research going into looking at that. What we know so far is that some kids, once they get to the preschool or early school age, can have issues with attention, but as far as longer-term effects, we really don't have the long-term studies to answer that question right now.
You mentioned that in rural communities it can be harder for the mothers, for instance, to get care, to see the doctors that they need. Is the same true for these babies that are being born in these communities? Are they able to get the care that they need?
So we don't know. And that was one of the big takeaways from the work that my team did was, wow, we're seeing this big increase in neonatal abstinence syndrome in rural communities. The next question is, gosh, are rural communities equipped to take care of these babies? We know that a lot of the babies that are being born with neonatal abstinence syndrome that are from rural communities are getting transferred to other hospitals, and presumably they're being transferred to larger hospitals, more urban hospitals, where there are more staff and resources there to deal with the baby's problems. But given the increase that we're seeing, I think it's an important question to take a hard look at how we support rural hospitals that are seeing increasing numbers of this and how we can best keep the mom and baby together.
We're talking with Dr. Nicole Villapiano right now. She's a researcher at the C.S. Mott Children's Hospital at the University of Michigan. She's a pediatrician. And we're looking at her study taking into account maternal opioid use and the effect on babies who are born there, seeing a spike in those numbers in rural communities. And Dr. Nicole Villapiano, what happens as a pediatrician? What would you like to see done in response to these numbers that you're seeing in rural communities?
So, obviously, we need to make sure that the babies are supported after they're born, and making sure that rural communities have the staff and resources to support those babies and moms for a healthy childhood is important. But I think even more important than that is taking a couple steps back and looking at what we can do in rural communities to address the issues why moms would start using opioids in the first place. And from other research, we know that opioid use often stems from untreated mental health or chronic pain issues. So having more resources and treatment options in rural areas for moms who are having those types of problems so that we can hopefully prevent opioid use in the first place is, I think, the best approach moving forward.
Now, we know here in Wisconsin that there is a shortage of mental health care in rural communities. Is that something that needs to be addressed further down the training chain for physicians and care providers?
I think you hit the nail on the head right there. We're seeing across the board, across the United States, major shortages of mental health workforce in rural communities, whether that's psychiatrists or counselors, therapists, professionals that can help patients with substance uses. All of these types of services are limited in rural areas, and we're seeing that it's becoming a bigger and bigger problem, especially with the opioid epidemic that's hitting rural areas so hard. So I completely agree with you that thinking about creative ways to bring more of those professionals into rural areas is an important next step.
Right, and given that the health of these babies is related to maternal opioid use, is related to mental health care in rural parts of the state, I mean, is there a coordinated approach that needs to be looked at maybe more big picture than it is right now?
So, absolutely. And I think that there's going to be a need for more data on exactly how mental health issues tie into these maternal and infant health outcomes that we described in our paper with the neonatal abstinence syndrome. Recently, there was a bill passed in the in Congress that was called the Comprehensive Addiction and Recovery Act, and there were specific measures of this bill that would allocate funding towards rural substance use treatment and prevention programs. And I think that that's a really great start, that we have that in place. And now with the 21st Century Cures Act that was just passed by Congress in the last month, there's hopefully the funding that can go towards those efforts passed in the Comprehensive Addiction and Recovery Act.
Dr. Villapiano, thank you for joining us.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
Dr. Nicole Villapiano is a pediatrician at the University of Michigan, and she works with its Institute for Healthcare Policy and Innovation. She joined us to talk about the serious toll that the opioid epidemic has taken on rural mothers and their babies.
Coming up after the news, the medical editor of the Mayo Clinic Diet joins us with some advice on building healthier habits in the new year. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.
Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, Republicans are trying to make good on their promise to repeal Obamacare. We'll get the latest on the battle over the health care law on Capitol Hill.
First, this time of year, people often resolve to make healthier choices, which might mean starting a diet. But a lot of diets and other New Year's resolutions end up abandoned, sometimes just after a few weeks. It's easy to lose steam after a couple of weeks, especially if we have big goals without a good plan in place.
Our guest says habits are the key. We need to start good habits and phase out bad ones. Dr. Donald Hensrud is with us now. He's the medical editor for the Mayo Clinic Diet. He's also medical director of the Mayo Clinic Healthy Living Program and specialist in nutrition and preventive medicine. Dr. Hensrud, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Well, why do you call this Mayo Clinic diet a lifestyle approach?
Great question. And we call it the Mayo Clinic diet for two reasons. One is there's been a so-called Mayo Clinic diet that's followed us around for 40 or 50 years, and there never was one until now. We put our oar in the water, and we created the Mayo Clinic diet to clear up this confusion. The second reason is the way people look for information on weight management is through the term diet. But the Mayo Clinic diet is much more than a diet. It's a lifestyle change program. But we wanted to get people's attention. We wanted to meet them where they're looking, and that's why we arrived at that name.
When people hear diet, I think words that might pop in their heads are willpower and sacrifice. And those are not words I see a lot in your book, that you're coming at it at a different angle.
You're exactly right. We try and get people to focus on the long term and on making positive, practical, and enjoyable lifestyle changes that are sustainable. The typical thing I see in my office is somebody will come in and they'll say, "Oh, I've got to go on a diet." And it's, you know, the world's coming to an end, and it's negative, it's restrictive, and that's the way we commonly approach these things. And therefore, it's going to be temporary. So we try a different approach with people. There's a lot of, as you can tell, a lot of positive information in there. We're their partner in this. And it's not easy, but it is possible. And we give people the tools to help them do this.
You've got to divide it into a couple of phases, a lose it phase and a live it phase. And the live it phase is the one everyone's trying to get to. But tell us how they're different.
Great question. And we know that people want to lose weight quickly. Tomorrow it couldn't be soon enough. And so we looked in the literature and we found all the things that we could find that are related to either decreased calories in, increased calories burned or weight management that are evidence-based, and they're related to habits. And we throw the kitchen sink at people. We ask people in the lose-it phase for 2 weeks to add five habits, break five habits, and adopt five bonus habits. And they're very simple things. When we did this in our pilot program, people lost, on average, 8 pounds in the first 2 weeks, and most people lost 6 to 10 pounds. Now, that's too fast long-term, but short-term, we were happy with this. It helped people break into weight loss. There's nothing unsafe about it because all of the habits were very simple and safe and practical. And so when they did this, it was challenging for people, but when they did this, they were quite successful. Some of the habits were, for example, eat breakfast. Now, that sounds kind of very simple, but in the literature, if you eat breakfast, you're more likely to manage weight long term. Eat more fruits and vegetables. Again, very simple, but it's something that we don't always do. We have good intentions, and if you look in the medical literature, people who eat more fruits and vegetables and people who change to eat more fruits and vegetables actually have a much easier time managing weight because they're not eating something else that's higher in calories. One of the more challenging ones for people in Break 5 Habits was no eating while watching TV, and you can only watch as much TV as the time you spend exercising. So that was a difficult one because oftentimes we eat TV. We're not telling people not to watch TV, but we often mindlessly munch while we're watching TV, and it's a sedentary activity. So we just want people to get moving, and the cumulative effect of all of these changes was the 8 pounds weight loss over 2 weeks.
Talking to Dr. Donald Hensrud from the Mayo Clinic, author of the Mayo Clinic Diet, part of the team that put this book together. And Dr. Hensrud, let's talk about some of those habits you mentioned. You know, eat vegetables and fruits. It's easy to say. I think by now we all know that we need to do it. And yet most of us probably need to do more of it. So how do we start planning that? How do we start making ourselves fall into that habit of eating more fruits and vegetables?
So in the lose it phase, we just tell people to go for it. We don't tell them how. We just jump in and try and swim. In the live it phase, that's where we transition people to long-term lifestyle changes. And we give people other tools. We use the Mayo Clinic Healthy Weight Pyramid to show people what types of foods they should eat. Fruits and vegetables are at the bottom. One of the things that people wanted and why we released the second edition was many people say, tell me what to do, and I'll do it. It's difficult for me to come up with ideas. So we came up with menus. We have 4 weeks of menus and new recipes in there that people can follow if they want that. And we also have in the back an action guide. Everybody has challenges in this area. We all know it sounds simple, eat less, exercise more, but really doing it is challenging. The interesting thing is that everybody has different challenges. So in the action guide, what we did, we took many of these challenges in diet. I don't like fruits and vegetables, for example, is one. And we give people practical strategies on how to deal with them. So if somebody doesn't like fruits and vegetables, well, maybe there's one or two they can focus on. Or maybe there are ways of putting vegetables in other foods, such as soups or casseroles. And so there may not be a perfect solution, but we think there are partial solutions for virtually every challenge.
Now, one tricky one of these habits, and this is in your bonus five habits section, after the holidays, is no sugar. A lot of us are a little sugared out, myself included, but after a while, I know I'm going to want to eat something with sugar again. So tell us about why that one you think is important.
So we put that in there because sugar intake, despite all the sugar-free products, has increased tremendously over the past few decades in this country, and it has been related to increased weight. So we think that's important. We're talking about added sugar here, so not the sugar in fruits. What we found in the two-week lose-it phase was that people, initially, they thought it was very challenging. But when they tried some of these things, when they got into it, it wasn't as bad as what they thought. It's only for 2 weeks. And once they got into it, for example, we had one of our patients used to put a lot of sugar in his coffee. And for that two-week period, it was tough to avoid sugar. Afterwards, however, after he became much more aware of how much he was putting in and how much he was consuming, he went back to just putting a little bit in. So it empowered people to try and make these changes when they were and they were successful during the lose-it phase. And then afterwards, they can work on putting them into long-term habits.
Well, I gave this a try today, actually. I was looking at the book, and I went out on my snack run, which usually ends up with a pastry or a cookie of some sort. I'm at the grocery store. Blueberries, not too expensive. I got those instead. I like blueberries. They're not as good with coffee. But is that part of the equation here, not just eliminate something else, something, but get something to take its place, fulfill its role in my life?
You're exactly right. If you look at the habits in the first section, we say eat more fruits and vegetables. Eat whole grains instead of refined grains like white flour and things like that. Eat healthy fats such as nuts and olive oil. And if you do that, then the focus is a positive message on what we can eat. And by subtraction, then you're not consuming something else that's higher in calories.
Well, in the same vein, another habit, no snacks. You want us to give up snacks, but not totally asterisk. Fruits and veggies are okay.
That's right. And again, the reason is that snacking is one of the things that's been shown to be related to increased calorie intake and increased weight. But if you, we're not telling people not to snack, but just try and focus more on fruits and vegetables. I hear from many of my patients that, I like fruits and vegetables, but they just don't seem to find their way into my diet. It's, something else is more convenient. But once people start to focus on this a little bit more, it becomes easier than what they thought, and they really appreciate the taste. Your blueberries, for example, I bet they weren't too bad.
They were good, and I separated them from the coffee, because coffee and blueberries, it just doesn't work. I don't know.
Dr. Hensrud, is there a fruit that does go well with coffee? I can't think of one.
I'd have to think about that. If there is, we could make some money on that one.
We're talking to Dr. Donald Hensrud right now about the new book, The Mayo Clinic Diet.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you stick with new health habits? Have you had a success story? Maybe one of the habits we've been talking about, cutting the snacks and the sugar, eating more fruits and veggies, getting more exercise. What worked for you to get you to do that? Or do you need some inspiration, some solutions, some help overcoming an obstacle to doing the stuff that you know is healthy, you just haven't made it part of your daily life? Call in now, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234.
We'll pick up our conversation in just a bit here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert, and we're picking up our discussion now with Dr. Donald Hensrud, medical editor for the Mayo Clinic Diet.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you someone who's been on and off diets over the years? Is there something that works for you, something that doesn't? Have you successfully made a health habit change, regular exercise, better eating, you name it, that you made stick over time for the long run, part of your daily life? Call us and tell us about it, or get some inspiration to help you do that, maybe in 2017. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234.
And we have a first caller now. Mark is with us in Milwaukee. Mark, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to ask?
I had a comment that the doctor was talking about fruit, and I have a habit that I've had for a few years now where I eat a banana at 10:30. This is at the office, as close to 10:30 as I can get it. And actually, it's become such a habit that I get hungry right around 10:30 and just eat that banana. And it's kind of an office joke, but it's worked for me. I've been a vegan since the mid-1980s, and I hardly get sick, even a common cold. I just don't seem to get that. Of course, I get exercise and stuff, too, but I think it's partly because of my diet. I have something I call a dessert exception, though. I have not been able to give up cookies and cake and stuff like that that come my way, so I'm not 100% vegan, but close to it.
Interesting. Thank you, Mark. And Mark's got a good habit with his banana break at 10:30 in the morning. Is that a good way to go, Dr. Hensrud?
Absolutely. I mean, he's made that a part of his lifestyle, and that he would, as he was alluding to, I think he'd be missing it if he didn't do it. So we can we develop habits that aren't so healthy or good for us, and we can form good ones. The other thing about fruit that is interesting, since we're talking about that, one of the reasons we recommend a lot of fruits and vegetables are they're low in what's called energy density. Now, that's a fancy term, but you could think of calorie density. What it means is for the bulk and volume that they have, they contain very few calories. if you think about it, it's not calories that fill you up. It's the volume or weight of food that we eat. So fruits and vegetables have a lot of weight, a lot of volume, and when you eat those, you're not getting in as much calories. For example, there's the same amount of calories in 1 1/3 sticks of butter as there is in 10 or 11 heads of lettuce or 35 cups of green beans. Now, you're not going to want to eat that, but the point is if people are eating more fruits and vegetables, they can actually eat more food and get in less calories.
Mark, thanks a lot for that call. We'll go next to Jared with us in Eau Claire. Jared, hi.
Hi, how's it going, guys?
Good. What did you want to tell us about?
I've been a truck driver for about 11 years now. Been having a hard time trying to manage weight, diet, this, that, and the other. I really can't seem to get below the 200-pound mark once I've reached it. You're 14 hours a day working, 11 of it driving, sitting. It's very hard to find, you know, a good balance between, you know, meals and time for exercise and things of that nature. And I was just kind of curious to see if what options out there, you know, for us guys and, you know, gals that work in this kind of environment.
And, Jared, not always the healthiest food available to you, I bet.
Oh, no. You go, you know, stop at the truck stop to get some fuel, and it's either hot dogs or McDonald's, Hardee's, you know, maybe a Subway here and there.
Jared, thanks for that call. Dr. Hendrud, advice for Jared?
Yeah, really good question. And that's, you know, we talked about challenges, and everybody has different challenges. And this is a big one because physical activity during the time that he's on the road is very difficult to do. I don't have an easy answer for that other than to say he'll have to emphasize diet a little bit more. And the good news is if you really look closely at the medical literature, it's more effective to lose weight through diet than it is in physical activity. Now, both are important, don't get me wrong, but if somebody tried to do it just through exercise, it's not as easy to do as if you do it through diet. So it is possible. Some suggestions that I would have for him, and the other thing that challenge he has is the time factor, that, you know, you can't starve yourself when you're sitting there all day. I think our program would work pretty well because, again, we allow all the vegetables and fruits that people want to eat. There's virtually unlimited amounts. So I'd encourage him to, he does have to put in some planning, some effort into food choices to carry good things with him in the truck. Whenever I travel, for example, I always carry fruit and some nuts in my computer case so I'm not caught having to eat whatever's there. And I think if he shifted what he ate rather than how much, on our program, I think that might help him out.
Jared, thanks a lot for that call, and good luck to you. And Dr. Hendrud, I want to ask you, you mentioned medical literature, and I'm starting to see more and more stories about how diets actually don't work, that people gain back the weight, and some people's bodies just don't have that metabolism set point. I mean, do you think we might one day be at the point where we're not talking about diets anymore, but we're talking about something else?
I think you're exactly right. And what I call that is a dieter's mentality, that people are either on a diet or off a diet. And we talked about that a little bit earlier on. The attitude that people have going into this is a drudgery. It doesn't have to be, I think, if people approach it in the right way. Instead of looking at something that you're either on or off, try and take baby steps and make small changes with lifestyle changes long term. Focus on the positive. Many people say, when I was more active, when I weighed a little less, I felt better. And so listen to that, and that can be real motivating. Focus on quality of life as well as weight loss. And sometimes people get too focused on the numbers on the scale. They want to lose 50 pounds in a very short period of time. My analogy with that, in business terms, it's like saying I want to make $1 million but not have a good financial plan on how to do it. So the planning and the process and the program is very important, and not necessarily focus only on the outcome. This sounds funny, but I tell my patients, if you're eating better and if you're more active, your health is going to improve even if you don't lose a pound. Now, obviously, that's one of the goals, but it can become a secondary goal, and paradoxically, it can become easier to lose weight if people take the pressure off the scale and just focus on making healthy lifestyle changes.
Dr. Donald Hendrud is with us to help us build some healthier habits for the long run. He's medical editor for the Mayo Clinic Diet. Back to your calls now with Jacob on the line in Eau Claire. Jacob, hi.
Hello, how are you?
Good. What's your story, Jacob?
Well, I was in the military, and to get in, I had to lose 30 pounds. And then once I got in, I lost 36 pounds, so I lost quite a bit of weight. And then when I had gotten out, I ended up putting all of that weight back on. And then for years, you know, it was hard to lose weight, and I couldn't really do it until I got my wife involved with me in losing the weight. And she really, you know, kind of worked with me quite a bit. We started meal planning and making all of our lunches and our dinners ahead of time for the family. And that seemed to really help out a lot. And then we, you know, we do a half hour to an hour of exercise every day after work, even though I was really tired, you know, from working. She, you know, she really helped me stay motivated and keep me at it. And, you know, I've lost, you know, a lot of weight. And then she didn't really have a lot to lose, but she's definitely lost a lot of inches. And, you know, we're both really happy with the progress we're making. And we even can get our kids to help us out and, you know, work out with us and stuff, and it's a lot of fun. It's become more of a lifestyle family activity, you know, and it's been really nice.
Jacob, thank you so much for sharing that story. And Dr. Hendrud, in the book, you talk about getting your family on board so they know what's going on with the changes in food and activity.
Boy, he should really be proud, and he's doing some really good things. Support is very important, whether it's family, coworkers, friends. They can really help out. And if you have a good support system, that can make a big difference, as it is in his case. The other thing he mentioned was planning. A lot of the work, so-called work, is in the planning. And if you plan well and have good food around, put in a little bit of time in preparing food, as he mentioned, it's well worth it, and it can go a long way. So he's doing a lot of really good things there.
Thanks a lot for that call, Jacob. Great story. And we're going to go next to Jesse in Waupaca. Jesse, hi.
Hi. I was just calling in. I wanted to mention my wife and I both lost about 130 pounds. And it really just it came from making a lot of substitutions throughout our diet and really just sticking to some exercise program.
So you lost 130 pounds each of you? Either way you slice is pretty incredible. Can you give us, Jesse, an example of a small change that you made that helped?
We did a lot of things like, you know, instead of eating rice, we started substituting quinoa for rice. When we went to eat bread, instead of eating bread, we went to whole grains instead of white. A lot of just, like, portion control is a real big part of it. And then a lot of just getting as much exercise as we can, whether it's walking, running. We now both compete and run in half marathons and marathons every year. So,
Jesse, thank you for calling. That's, I'm sure, inspiring to lots of people listening right now. And he's saying, yeah, maybe it's better to break it down into these small steps, Dr. Hensrud.
Again, very good story. And the things that these people are talking about, they're not earth-shattering. It's planning. It's small steps. And over time, if you stick with them, if it's practical, if it's enjoyable, then these things can be sustainable, and these people should be very proud of that.
Dr. Hendrud, leave us with a couple things people can maybe start doing at dinner time tonight.
Eat more. Eat more vegetables and fruits. That's one of our habits, and people will be surprised that they don't have to decrease the amount that they're eating of those foods. They're low in calories. A couple other things. One is, The lifestyle that leads to healthy weight doesn't have to be drudgery. As we've talked about, it can be practical, safe, enjoyable, and therefore sustainable over time. If people want more information, the book's available in stores everywhere. It's available online at our website, mayoclinic.org. And if people want to take a deep dive into weight loss, we have an on-site program at the Mayo Clinic Healthy Living Program in Rochester, Minnesota, and they can Google us at Mayo Clinic Healthy Living if they're interested in that.
Dr. Hendrud, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
That's Dr. Donald Hendrud, medical editor of the Mayo Clinic Diet. He's also medical director of the Mayo Clinic Healthy Living Program and specialist in nutrition and preventive medicine. Share your health improvements, changes you've made. Tweet us right now at Central Time WPR. Today is National Bird Day, an effort to appreciate birds and to draw attention to threats facing vulnerable species.
The day comes at the end of a three-week bird count that assesses the well-being of native species and also draws attention to the treatment of captive bird species.
Last year at this time, you quizzed me on some bird sounds. I think I did really well, right?
I think you got a big goose egg is what I remember.
0 for 3. I thought we wanted a low score. Well, I've pulled some bird sounds for you, so it's your turn. You ready?
All right, I am ready.
Okay, bird sound number one.
That sounds like
Hold on. Wait. Okay, why did you get full?
Oh, okay, yeah, I see. Because that changed everything
right.
When I heard the last two caws. I'm going to say crow.
Oh, crow, you got it. Okay, all right, that was an easy one. That was a warm-up.
All right.
Okay, now we'll get a little trickier now. Here we go, number two. Any guesses?
That would be...
the official bird of Central Time.
Is it a craw-billed bitter-crested parasitic Jaeger?
It's a parasitic Jaeger. You got,
got it.
Yes, my favorite new
All
bird.
Right, thanks for the hint.
One more. Number three real quick.
Turkey vulture?
It's a llama. And the interesting thing about the llama, it is not, scientifically speaking, a bird.
That's not fair.
At all. Celebrating National Bird Day, this is Central Time.